February 23rd, time for the Mincing Rascals. I'm Steve Bertrand, your erstwhile fill-in host, while John Williams travels the world on vacation. I'm also the host of the Business Lunch on WGN Radio.
So I'm Scott Stantis, editorial cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune. I also do the Prickly Sea podcast right here on WGN Plus.
I'm Eric Zorn. I'm an incumbent columnist at the Tribune, Wednesdays, Fridays, Sundays, 3 days a week.
Do we know where John Williams is? He just said he was off on vacation.
He said, I'm not going to be here. And I just saw Kristen, our other Mincing Rascal, and she just looked like she had it this morning. She's got some deadlines. She may wander up here, she said.
Oh, good. Well, she's been blowing us off left and right.
I know. You know, I don't know what it is.
It's high school all over
something
again.
Something we said.
Kristen has her eye on Springfield and big news out of Springfield. Shocking news, really. The state workers union AFSCME voted 81% in favor of on a strike authorization vote. On a strike authorization vote, 81%.
Wow, I'm stunned.
Are you?
Well,
no, not at all.
He's not stunned because these strike authorization votes are just about getting leverage.
This is like a vote in the House when the Senate still has to weigh in. Right?
Yeah, it gives more leverage to the union negotiators when they know they've got the strike authorization vote. It's a card they can play. And whether they're actually going to go out on strike, a strike is a big deal for a lot. I mean, we're talking about 38,000 workers. Not all of them would go off the job because I think some of them are prison guards and you know, what we call essential employees. But this would be an amazingly major event in our state if AFSCME went on strike. I think that they know that, and they know that the governor knows that, and so they're hoping that this inspires more and better negotiation.
But put it in its lane, and maybe, Scott, you can do this, because this is, I mean, there's the overwhelming or the overarching budget standoff. There's the pension problem. And this, in a way, sort of stands on its own, right? It's on a separate track, the AFSCME negotiations.
Well, it's all, I mean, there's an organic intertwining of all these things. So I think this is the dumbest thing. I mean, but it just comes on top of a whole pile of stupid in the state. They're going to strike really on a state that has no money, that, you know, what, daily has an $11 million deficit that's building daily, that's now in the billions upon billions upon billions of dollars. And they're striking for what? For more money than a state that doesn't have it. It's like the guys who redo the deck chairs on the Titanic. They're going on strike. Oh, well, damn.
Oh, in some ways they're striking for not less money. I mean, because some of the proposals that have been floated to them, making them, you know, people pay for much more of their own health care, and so it means that they're going to take home less pay.
What does that mean? They're not paying much for the health care now.
Well, they're going to pay more, so they're going to take home less.
Which means $4 a month?
Well, I'm going to say, all I'm saying, Scott, is I don't think they necessarily want more. They're not going to get more money out of this. They're just hoping to lose less money out of this. And I'm not taking a side in this. I really don't know all the equities in this debate, but I do know that when you vote to strike, it's just basically to give your negotiators another card to play. I wouldn't read too much into that right now.
I think you read a lot into it. I think it tells you the temperament and of the state workers, of AFSCME itself, which has clearly been advocating for this vote. And I believe they will pull the trigger. And this state, as abysmal shape as it's in now, I mean, can we just does Iowa absorb us? What happens?
Well, go ahead.
I was kind of hoping for
not Iowa. Anyone but Iowa.
Well, not anyone but Iowa. Not Kansas. What strikes me about this is that
he's a word guy.
I really wanted Lisa Madigan to prevail in court last week. She failed. She went to court trying to get the state to stop paying workers on this continuing basis without an appropriate allocation from the legislature. This is, you know, extra constitutional, let's put it that way, which is that, you know, these people are being paid even though there's been no formal legislation authorizing their payment. And Lisa Madigan has finally said, look, let's stop this. And her clear goal, she's pretty upfront about this, is to create a crisis that forces everybody to the table to come up with a solution to this budget standoff, which has been going on since July 2015.
Well, and that's, I was going to quote one of my favorite columnists who sort of maybe said inartfully that the state needs a Katrina, right? a big event.
Yeah.
And I think that she was right in that, and maybe the strike, while the state might not be able to withstand it or whatever, is the Katrina. Or the, and I shouldn't even use that first, but is the catastrophic sort of event that can force something to finally happen.
I always thought that the governor's play on this was exactly wrong, in that it's like, you know, this death by a million paper cuts versus what you're suggesting, which I think is the right way he should have gone, which is everything should have stopped. Everything should have sat down. It should have been catastrophic for a lot of, for, you know.
I don't know who wins on the catastrophe.
It's a big game of chicken.
Yeah, it's sure a big, no, but what, the thing is, when something like that happens, something has to be resolved. And so we would have, instead of this, like, painful slog of attrition that, and nothing has been resolved. Nothing.
Well, but, and it's not, we're falling behind. People say it's $11 million a day. I've seen estimates as high as $33 million a day. That because we're paying it, we're paying out at these, you know, the court has mandated that we pay all these things out, and we've got all these, you know, side agreements and so on. 90% of state government is being funded, but we don't have that much money. So we're falling further and further and further behind. We are cutting human service programs in higher education as we go along. And that has a long-term cost as well. If you've got kids who are not getting early childhood medical and educational interventions, if you've got, you know, seniors who have to go into nursing homes rather than being able to stay at home, if you've got all these other things are actually building up, this is not an abstract problem. This is not just a bunch of numbers on a balance sheet. This is a problem that's actually hurting the state. It's actually hurting our ability to provide the services that we need to provide, education, public safety, all those kind of things. And so it is. I mean, I agree with Scott. And I don't know exactly who or what shakes out when you have an emergency, but they do need more of a sense of urgency all around to get this done.
All right, so that is the state level. Nationally, this was the week that the Trump administration had said they were going to come out with their revised immigration executive order. They didn't. Looks like now next week. But they did come out with this new sort of list of guidelines when it comes to people who may or may not be deported, illegals who may or may not be deported, and greatly expands it.
It looks like they really have. I mean, you got to remember that President Obama was deporting people at a fairly robust rate.
The deporter-in-chief.
The deporter-in-chief, he was called. And he was going after criminals. He was going after felons and so on. It looks as though they have expanded this to include people who are not just convicted of crimes, but who are suspected of crimes, not even charged in some cases. And also they seem to be lowering the level of offense to, you know, down to things like, you know, if you get caught drunk driving or you get caught without a taillight or something like that, that you can, if you break the law in any way. And there's a lot of alarm. So far, I don't know that it's been it's resulted in an increased number, a dramatically increased number yet.
Of deportation.
Yes. Now, again, you know, we have to always have to say when we're recording. You know, this is where it's a little bit after 11 on Thursday, and by the afternoon, it could be, you know, there could be mass roundups.
Well, but, you know, and the deportation force is an unfortunate term, maybe, but they also announced plans to increase by the thousands, maybe tens of thousands, the number of ICE agents and border agents.
I believe there's 10,000.
There's 15,000 of one and 5,000 of another, wasn't there? There were two groups.
And the interesting thing about that is that, first of all, it's going to cost a lot of money to do that. I mean, it's not cheap if you're going to hire all these agents, and building this wall is not going to be cheap. And actually physically deporting people is not cheap. It requires, you know, transporting them. It requires holding them. It requires, you know, overseeing their legal cases and so on. All this stuff costs a lot of money. Plus, it takes money out of the economy when you're taking these workers who are doing a lot of this work that we do they can't find Anglos to do, for instance, in Southern California. They're taking those people out of the economy then. And that's going to be a blow. Also, I mean, this is not exactly just, you know, for people who are very, you know, staunch about illegal immigration. This is not just a feel good story like, oh, it's all good. This is going to be a problem for people who think they have no contact with this.
I have complex issues with this. I have to admit, complex feelings about this. But the thing that we keep saying, immigrants, immigration, immigration. The salient point is illegal immigrants.
Right, right, that's right.
That never gets thrown on the headlines. That never gets thrown in the stories. It's always immigrants or no illegal immigrants. And there's the illegal part is important.
The crackdown on the immigrants is coming next, maybe with the visas. But now,
here's the point, and this is where I'm going to segue back to my own sense of libertarianism, I suppose, and that is that, you know, they came here for a reason. They didn't come here to be evil or to undermine the country. They came here to work hard. Contribute, not fully because they're not legal citizens, but contribute to the culture, raise their kids in a better place than they came from. Those are very American virtues, and I would encourage those. And I would say that the better response, rather than, can you imagine what the optics of this is going to be? You're going to have ICE agents kicking down. I'm not kidding. You're not kicking down doors, separating families. It's going to. That sounds like some liberal, you know, MSNBC construct. It's not. It's not.
You're already seeing some stories like that, but I just don't know how many stories like that we weren't hearing during the Obama
years. I was going to say, I think they were happening.
Yeah, but there's stories parents being picked up at their kids' soccer games and taken to deportation facilities and so on. Yes, Scott's right, and these are people who are here without proper documentation. They're in this. I know the term illegals is kind of a loaded term, but they are in the country illegally. They don't have the proper documentation to be here, and we do have to wrestle with this question of what do we want the policy to be? What if you've been here for X number of years, if you've got kids who were born here, if you've got a spouse who is a citizen, what do we do with people who are actually really embedded in our culture? Do we just say no, you're gone, or do we provide them with a pathway to citizenship? And if we do, does that offend the people who are waiting in line the way you're supposed to wait in line? Scott's raising his hand. So.
No, I was waving at someone.
Scott, he was not paying attention. Scott talked about Scott brought up the people, the people you want here, the people who want to come in for the work ethic and to find a better mm-hmm. life and all of that. There was a study by, I think it's called the American Psychological Association, something like that. And they do an annual survey of our stress levels. And we're more, and over the past 10 years, Americans have becoming less and less stressed. That changed in the 2017, and they're blaming the election for that. But I bring it up because it speaks to how suggestible we are. And the illegals aren't being packaged as hardworking family people. They're being packaged as criminals. And this study showed how we're more afraid of crime now than we have been in the past. Specifically, because I remember these numbers, that's why I'm bringing this one up, terrorism. They asked the Americans in August about their fear of terrorism, and 51% said they feared it. They asked them again in January, and the number was up to 59%. Nothing has happened other than rhetoric, other than the talking around it and the threats around it. And I think that is the case with the fight against the illegals as well.
All those bad hombres we're hearing about.
Let me ask you a question that will get, my Twitter feed going, I guess. But what's the harm in these illegals being here? I mean, I don't mean that naively. I really don't quite understand why we need to get rid of them.
Especially when you have a large number in, say, Southern California or Texas or Arizona, places I've lived in Arizona and Southern California. When you have a large influx of immigrants like that, undocumented workers, you get a pretty large community that has a lot of poverty. Poverty lends itself to crime.
Okay.
And so the frustration and the other frustrations in Southern California, you walk down your street in your town and there is signage and you can't go into an establishment to buy something because you don't speak the language even. And it's a frustration. But it's nothing that I got to admit. It's nothing that bothered me a heck of a lot. And I agree with you. I think there should be made an easy way to citizenship right now.
I don't know the answer to this question, but does it lower wages? I mean, there are studies about this.
It would have to.
Well, maybe, but maybe not. Maybe the jobs that these men and women are doing are jobs that would not be done by, that these are not the jobs that American citizens are looking for.
There was apparently John F. Kennedy was part of this eliminating the rancheros, and there was a pathway in and out for a number of ranch workers to come in the 60s, and he cracked down on that. Someone looked at the impact on that on wages, and there wasn't much of one.
Yeah, I'm skeptical about that. And of course, they do. They work in our restaurants. They work in our fields. They work in our office buildings. These are people who are contributing to society, and they are paying Social Security taxes. In many cases, they're certainly paying sales taxes when they buy things. They are contributing to our society. They're also creating a burden on society. Scott mentions walking down the street. Things I've read people complain about, they overburden schools, public schools. They overburden, the healthcare system.
What does that mean that they overburden schools? They're paying, if they're paying rent, they're contributing to property taxes or state taxes paying for those schools.
I would say, numbers and also academic achievement. Because you come to this country, you don't speak English. You're taught in English, and so that's going to slow down your learning for a while.
Okay. Yeah. But I don't know if that, I don't see that as a reason. I see that.
You need additional resources to address that, also just the sheer numbers that come in.
Yeah, I mean, I'm out of my depth here, I admit, because I haven't studied the pluses and minuses of this, but I do know that it's not a simple question. I think I agree with what Scott was saying earlier, is that I've conflicted feelings. I mean, I feel like a nation should control its borders. It should control its immigration. We should probably have more work permits. We should have people here. We should let them be here, let them work here, as long as we're convinced that it is to our advantage. That, you know, that makes sense to me. I don't know exactly what I would want to do with people who have been here. You know, if someone crosses the border and is here for 30 days or 30 hours, I can see sending them back. If they've been here 30 years, do I think right. and they're acculturated, their families are here? I mean, I don't see a point in ripping apart families for the purpose of the principle that I'm talking about here.
I think there's a common sense, and I know this is a word that no one is using nowadays, but there's a common sense and a middle approach to this that's a middle ground that addresses what Eric is saying, and that, you know, as I said, a road to citizenship that's fairly easy, and then have a worker, you know, registration on the border. You have a car, that we know you're here. And that just seems to me there are simple solutions. I mean, they're not cheap, but there are simple solutions to this.
Well, it will probably come up at CPAC as the conservatives are meeting. all of them there except for Milo Yiannopoulos.
That's a darn shame.
You know, fascinating guy. And
he's big with the kids.
He's big with the kids. and they finally found something, right? Pedophilia. Some of his comments he made in a video that chased him, made him no longer the darling that he was. But this guy was a Breitbart editor. The college students were enthusiastic about him, some of them. He's the guy who was going to speak at DePaul and got shouted down. He's the guy who caused prompted the riots at Stanford.
Berkeley,
I'm sorry. And so now, finally, with this video, they've chased him. He was going to speak at CPAC and was
uninvited. He's a contrarian. I mean, he was one of these guys. I mean, he's the creation, in my view. There's a bigger issue here, and we won't go into that. But other than that, you know, clickbait, and that's what becomes passes for our political discussion nowadays. He had given an interview. He was talking about pretty much diddling 13-year-old boys.
Men diddling 13-year-old boys.
Yes. Well, him. He is a grown man. Well.
Sorry. I don't know if he's doing it, but he was defending.
He was defending it.
Yeah.
And then did you read his explanation?
Well, then he said because he was a victim when he was a young.
He was a victim and he was tired and he didn't articulate. No, honest to God, listen to what he's saying. There's no fuzziness here. It's pretty much grown men should sleep with boys.
Well, I mean, the one thing that was interesting to me was that finally they crossed this line for the far right, which is like, well, all this sexism and homophobia. I mean, he's gay, but he's bashing gays, bashing women, and racism and all that other stuff that is implicit in stuff that he was saying. That was okay with CPAC. That was okay with Simon & Schuster, who was going to publish his book. That was okay with Breitbart, who employed him. But suddenly, when he crosses this line into
pedophilia?
He crosses the line into that, then he's gone. And but the thing, you know, Scott reminds me that this is like a common kind of person that we've seen for years. These people who are just say outrageous things, and they know that it gets a lot of attention. You can make a lot of money saying just nutty stuff and getting people all riled up. And he was just another one of those people. And then they sort of cycle through, and maybe he'll just disappear. Maybe he's gone too far. Maybe he's David Duke now, which is my theory. He wanted to be Ann Coulter, and he turned into David Duke.
Yeah, I think he'll be less than David Duke. But you two are champions of the First Amendment. What strikes me was when he was not allowed to speak at Berkeley, there were people on the left and right talking about free speech. Like, well, this guy, you know, these schools, these left-wing schools now are no longer fostering free speech. And in the honor of free speech, he should have been allowed to speak. My reaction to that was, well, I don't think that he who utters hate speech should be championed as a free speech guy, right? I mean, you don't have to allow a hate speaker there to uphold the First Amendment.
Who's to say what hate speech is?
Well, I don't know.
You can have any number of far left speakers talking about, you know, and very ugly terms about people they disagree with, and that's okay. No, this is. I'm sorry, I disagree with you.
It's one of these things I don't quite get yet. I don't know.
Because the First Amendment's absolute. Because the First Amendment protects your right. Unless you're inciting to violence, you can say any stupid thing you want. In fact, I would insist that you do, so I know that you're a moron.
But should an institution be obligated or feel some sort of obligation to have even extreme, I will say hate speakers, speak at their institution in the name of free speech? That's sort of my point.
I'm trying to think.
I mean, I think the rioting's never a good idea. I'm not defending that. But I'm just saying that I don't think that anyone should feel an obligation. I think there's a point where if you make your point in a hateful way, then You don't have to. You don't get to use the First Amendment to make me to allow you to speak in my place.
Well, neither DePaul nor Berkeley was. First of all, the university didn't sponsor them, right, or invite them or pay them. They basically allowed a student group, I think, and I know at DePaul it was a student group. I'm assuming it was also at Berkeley a student group that did this. And I feel like what you don't want is your university, especially your public university, which Berkeley is refereeing what is okay speech and what isn't okay speech, unless it crosses the line into actually inciting violence. You want to say, okay, you are a student group. You want to hire you want to rent a room and have this guy speak here. Okay, fine. And if I'm the campus radicals and the anarchists, maybe I pick at the guy, but maybe I just ignore him. I mean, the thing is, this guy feeds off the negative attention that he gets. If he were just talking to people who wanted to hear him speak, there are a lot of, you know, crazy type people, like the Westboro Baptist Church people. Nobody pays them any mind, really, and they're insignificant. Their views have no purchase. I don't understand why, by paying all this attention to this guy, by getting riled up by him, you lend him credibility and power that he wouldn't otherwise have.
And mark my words, within the next 10 days, he will have his book, I'm making air quotes here, which is always, you know, good on podcasts.
It's great for podcasts.
But his book will land at another publisher. Guaranteed. Guaranteed, and it will sell well. It will sell better than it probably would have otherwise.
Maybe.
No doubt.
Well, no, better than it would have sold with the backing of Simon & Schuster, I'd be surprised. But it may sell, sure. He could self-publish it, and it would probably sell. But he is marginalizing himself. He's not. I don't think he's going to be on Bill Maher again.
Oscars are coming up on Sunday. Eric, what are you wearing? I mean, who are you wearing?
I'm wearing I'm wearing sweatpants to watch it on TV.
That would be Champion. You're wearing Champion?
Yes. I'll be wearing a Blackhawks sweat tie.
There was a survey from the Hollywood Reporter that said 66% of Donald Trump supporters tune it off, will not be watching. They've turned it off because they don't like the political speeches.
I am not a Donald Trump supporter, but I am pretty conservative, and I've stopped watching things like the Grammys or the People's Choice Award or the Oscars just because, do I really want to hear speeches from these people? I really don't. I just want to see, oh, great, you won for this movie. God, you did a great job. Way to go.
You know what I do? I DVR the whole thing. I usually watch the opening monologue, and then I DVR the rest of it, and I watch the news feed, and if something happens that people say, oh, did you see what so-and-so did or said, then I'll go fast forward through and watch that. Otherwise, I think it's kind of dull.
Really?
Yeah,
I love it. Every year I watch it, and at about 9:58, I start complaining that they can't finish it by 10. By 10:23, I go to bed, say, screw it, I'm not going to stay up. And then at 4:45, when I wake up the next morning, I find out who wins the Best Picture.
What should you do with the Chicago, Press Association, the one that...
The Lissagors?
Yeah, the Lissagors.
They just rifle them out?
Yeah, that's how they should do it. They literally just stand up there and they say, okay, best cartoonist, Scott Stennis, best columnist, right, Eric Zorin, best da, 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 and you literally stand in line for your plaque.
Right. It's an odd thing that...
Well, I think they ought to do... I mean, the greatest award show, and the one that I actually do watch, is the Grammys, because they don't waste their time with, best tape on the recording studio floor kind of awards. They just have the top few awards,
and
the rest of them they put on some sort of other broadcast or their feed, because you really don't want to see. I mean, I love folk music, but I can see why they don't have the best folk album. I mean, they have a Grammy for it, but they just don't have it on the telecast. That makes sense.
A good way to jump
I actually like the Tonys because I'm apparently the gayest straight guy I know. I really do. I love the Tonys.
You love the Tony Awards?
I do.
Really? Isn't it only four plays win every year?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, okay. Well, since we're being so cultured now, what are our recommendations for the week?
I watched something on PBS. Yes, I'm a Republican who watches PBS. And they did it's an animated documentary on the University of Texas Tower shooting called Tower.
I've heard about this.
Oh, my God. I literally cried. I literally gasped a couple of times. It is so well done, so well told, that I cannot recommend this high enough.
And it's on which service?
PBS?
PBS, that's right. Oh, my goodness.
I think Meredith Vieira a producer of that?
Was she?
I have a feeling. I heard her interviewed once recently about a movie she was making on that subject. So
It is absolutely wonderful. It tells the story from a bunch of different perspectives. The actual shooter gets very, very little comment. They don't talk about him at all, but the other people who are victims and who went and actually stormed the tower. I mean, it's just an amazing story, and it's beautifully told.
It was much more shocking back then because we weren't
first
used,
time.
We weren't used to this kind of thing happening in America, where someone would take out a bunch of people like that.
Yeah,
the
shooter turned out to be a Marine sharpshooter. He actually had killed his mother and his wife, like at midnight the day before he took the guns, and he went up there with an arsenal. And so these stories nowadays, if this happened today, it would be like page six. And there's another one.
Another one, yeah. So, first of all, I went and watched 13th.
Right,
the
13th. You had mixed feelings.
I had mixed feelings about 13th. Have you seen this yet?
No.
This documentary about essentially about the prison industrial complex and its effect on African Americans and so on. And it was just, I mean, I think it's, we don't have time for a full conversation about it, but we probably could, just about how it talks about how, you know, how racism in the criminal justice system has really poisoned a lot of African American history, and it tells a lot of stories, but I feel like it doesn't it skims over the surface of a lot of issues that I thought were kind of important. And you know, I get it; it's a documentary; it can't fill out everything. But I had mixed feelings watching it. Like, I thought they were stealing a few bases, the filmmakers.
That's a good phrase, stealing a few bases. I watched it; I wasn't I didn't buy into all of it. I thought it was very provocative, made me think.
Yeah.
And I will see how it does, because it's nominated for an Oscar.
It's on Netflix. And yeah, I mean, I really recommend watching it. Some excellent interviews, some incredible archival footage and stuff. But anyway, this is a complete change from that. My recommendation for this week is a new podcast from First Look Media. Do you guys remember Serial, the phenomenon that
Serial was
a couple years ago? I think this is the next Serial. Everyone's looking for the next Serial. I think this is it. Stay with me on this. It's called Missing Richard Simmons.
Oh,
and it is,
I've heard of this.
It's now, its second episode just went up. I haven't listened to that yet. The first episode was terrific. And essentially, you know, we all know Richard Simmons, this, you know, over-the-top, right, flamboyantly weird exercise guru, multimillionaire, the Sweating with the Oldies guy. He disappeared 3 years ago, which I was only vaguely aware of. And this a filmmaker who I guess used to work for maybe the does he work for the Daily Show? Maybe. I mean, he's a plugged in kind of guy. He was actually had taken some classes from Simmons and knew him a little bit. Has gone after and trying to find him, find out what happened to him. There's all kinds of theories as to what happened to him. But in the course of this, he's telling the story of this phenomenal guy's rise to fame and how deeply weird he is and how sad in some ways his story is. It's really, really good listening. It's called Missing Richard Simmons. It's wherever you're. Fine podcasts are served from First Look Media.
Really, I don't have much. I've been struggling with books. So I went back to an author I've been reading since I took a group to Scotland a few years ago, a guy named Peter May. And he wrote a trilogy set in the Hebrides Islands that I devoured. And he's got a book out called Entry Island, which is the Magdalen Islands. You ever heard of them? They're in at the sort of the mouth of the St. Lawrence Seaway off the Gaspé Peninsula. And when the boats would come from Scotland and Ireland, they would pass these Magdalen Islands on their way to Quebec. A lot of shipwrecks around there, and a lot of refugee or survivors ended up living on these islands. And so he's got this murder mystery set there and tied to a 19th century story about the Scottish famine, the potato famine, or being chased off the farms by the landlords there and coming and sort of mixing it all together. It's called Entry Island, and it's at your library because it's been out a couple years. All right, that's going to do it for the Mincing Rascals on this exciting episode. Thanks very much to producer Craig Collins and engineer Ben Cortez. And I thought John Williams was particularly eloquent today. I thought he did a great job.
Best ever.
John Williams, he's the guy. He's the guy who usually hosts this.
Maybe next week.
I love the Star Wars thing. He did a great job at that.
You little rascal, you! You little rascal, you! You little rascal, you!